Here we are, day three of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Wow, time really flies. Better put a timer on there, I'll get in trouble. I'll do that. We've already gone through the process again this year. We've searched the house, the cars, the office. We've dug into the cupboards. We've looked into the shelves. We've read labels like FBI agents to see if there's anything we can uncover. And work to make sure that what God says should not remain in our homes is removed. We do that because the instruction is clear in Exodus 13:7, where God commands us that unleavened bread should be eaten 7 days, and that no leavened bread should be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among all of our quarters. Each year, this gives us an opportunity to slow down and look more intently, inwardly. There's a pattern. We search, we remove, and we keep watch. We continue with that frame of mind for all 7 days. We continue with that same frame for all 7 days. And we are learning to pay attention, to take care, and to follow through and stay with the matter. To stay with the matter instead of touching on it once and then moving on. It's interesting, when you pull leaven out, you're not to allow it back in. Not even that donut that I've heard rumors in Louisville. I don't know if this will make it back there. That there was somebody putting donuts in the members' cars. We'll see if that circulates back and comes back to us. Troublemakers up there, I tell you. But that is where the spiritual lesson begins to open up for us. Paul brings it into focus in 1 Corinthians 5, in verses 6 through 8, when he speaks about leaven working through the whole lump, and how the negative and unlawful behavior of that old leaven can contaminate the entirety of your lump. If you will, instead, strive to keep the feast with sincerity and truth, the unleavened bread of the heart. He takes what God gave in the physical practice and shows how deeply it reaches into the inner heart of each one of us, and thereby trains us to think seriously about what remains, what spreads, and what needs to be dealt with. We are to focus on what is inside that leavens us wrongly, and work to remove it. Consider David's prayer in Psalm 139, in verses 23 and 24, where David is saying to this level, "Search me, O God," in Psalm 139, verse 23, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxieties, and see if there is any wicked way in me, and lead me into the way of everlasting." David had a good picture of what it meant to de-leaven himself. And he knew that it wasn't through his effort, but it was through God that he would be able to do such. To think this way is life. It is the message of the days of unleavened bread. We are encouraged to have a willingness to be searched. An open mind to see, and then to ask God to direct us in a way to depart from the old man. And as the Israelites learned, and we have also, leaving Egypt was one thing. Getting Egypt out of us takes much longer. It takes honesty, patience, and most of all, God's Spirit working in us to search out the inner crevices of our hearts and to find all that is out of alignment with God. Can we consider, as we go through these days, that God is teaching us something very, very important. He's teaching us how to keep moving in the right direction long enough for it to shape us. I caught that, James. Can we consider that he wants us to do this long enough to where it takes shape in us? If we cannot govern ourselves in the spirit how can we be ready to govern anything greater? The first thing we notice is how the feast teaches each of us to hold that steady line for 7 days. One thing that stands out with this is that God does not only tell us to remove leaven and to be done with it, he tells us to remove it and for the remainder of the 7 days to keep it out. And that latter part matters a lot because it comes with a warning. In Exodus 12:15, we read what sounded like 13:7, but it's slightly different. It says, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove the leaven from your houses. For whoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. It matters that we follow the requirements that he has for us. It's one thing to search the house, find the leaven, and clear it out. That takes effort. We all know. It does, but once that's done, the instruction continues. For the whole week, we are to eat unleavened bread, and no leaven is to be seen among our quarters. That teaches a pattern. It teaches us a line of thought. You begin at a point in time, and you stay with that same objective for the whole time. No breaks, no easing off. No letting us drift. We commit to the end and we do the work. The lesson is to keep the leavening from regaining a place in our homes. God is building in us during this week a mind that knows how to stay on task. You search, you remove, and then you continue in the same thinking for 7 days. You watch what enters. You watch what remains. You hold your priorities in place. And this is very close to how real spiritual growth actually works. God shows us something, then he expects us to stay with it. To work on it. To keep it in front of us. To not let it slip just because the first effort had already been made. This process teaches us to keep going until it becomes part of how we think. And in that sense, God not only is teaching us to inspect, he's also showing us how to manage and how to hold the line. The feast teaches us how to hold a godly line over time. Joseph shows us what happens when God takes that same lesson and builds it into a life preparing for rulership. Joseph is helpful here, as we think about it, because his life did not move in a dramatic leap. God worked with him across multiple stages. At 17 years old, Joseph was still in his father's house. We can read that in Genesis 37:2. But he was young, but already had responsibility. God was already working with him through dreams. And that's where I want to pick up the story today. In Genesis 37, and I'll have to summarize this because there's not enough time to read through the entirety of Joseph's story. But in Genesis 37, 5 through 11, it says, in his youth, Joseph was given dreams that pointed towards rulership. His brothers heard those dreams and responded with hatred and envy because they understood that the dreams spoke of authority and dominion. Jacob didn't fully understand them either, but he did not dismiss them. He kept the matter in mind. While Joseph still had years of shaping ahead of him. So before Joseph had a position, he had direction. He, like we, had a glimpse of the kingdom, and in his case, he had a glimpse of his future and rulership. As the story goes on and through verses 23 through 28, we find that Joseph came to his brothers expecting one thing, walking up with his coat of many colors, and walked into an entirely different situation. They stripped his coat from him. They marked his father's favor and cast him into an empty pit. And there, while he sat helpless, they sat down to eat. Then when these traitors, the Ishmaelites, appeared on their way to Egypt, they pulled Joseph out and sold him for 20 shekels of silver. In a matter of moments, Joseph went from the favored son to the rejected brother to a man being carried into the future, which he did not choose. This seems like a tragic story at this point, and certainly it was for young Joseph, but God did not leave him. He didn't leave him alone to fend for himself. As the story continues in chapter 39, what looked like loss became training. In Egypt, Joseph was purchased by Potiphar. Yet the Lord was with him so clearly that even the master recognized it. Joseph gained favor and was placed over the household of Potiphar. And eventually all that Potiphar had was entrusted to him. The slave had become the steward, and God had was quietly shaping a ruler long before anyone could see the end of history. Joseph was learning stewardship. He was learning trustworthiness. He was learning how to carry responsibility. The story continues where we find Joseph finds another test in the household. In the very house where he had gained trust, temptation came across. As often it does, Potiphar's wife set her desire on him and pressed him. But Joseph refused her. He understood what happened had been placed in his hand. What Potiphar had given him, he took seriously. He understood the trust that had been given. And above all, he understood what a great wickedness it would be to sin against God. The pressure did not come once and pass, but it came day by day. Day by day. But Joseph held his ground. So while he was learning to manage the household, he was also learning how to resist evil. It's true with us also. We face the enemy. He creates trouble for each one of us. It isn't so. We face this. We face it daily. Have you ever asked yourself lately, why in the world am I facing this? Why is this going on? I've done nothing to deserve this. Well, the temptation came one day for Joseph when he went into the house to do his work. And she seized him by his garment, Potiphar's wife, and he fled from her presence. Joseph chose purity, but the choice didn't spare him from suffering shortly. She used the garment against him, accused him before the household and before her husband. And yes, Joseph was thrown into prison, and his obedience to God led him into another painful stage of life. What? I did not do anything wrong. You and I might ask the same question. We may have that same perspective. Why are we suffering such things when I did nothing that deserves this treatment? Then we find the amazing thing happens again. Joseph chooses to act in a very positive way. And again, responsibility was given to him. What did he do with it? He was cast in prison. And what looked like confinement, and it would have looked like that, I'm sure, to you and I. But God was with Joseph in prison, and just as he had been with him in the house, mercy was shown to him. Favor was given to him, and again, responsibility found its way into his hands. Even there, Joseph was learning how to carry trust under God. One of the things that stands out most in Joseph's life, the surroundings changed, but the line he drew never did. House, slavery, temptation, prison. The setting keeps moving, the stages keep shifting, but Joseph kept growing. He kept serving. Our lives likewise move through stages. Some are easier than others, granted. Some make sense to us. Some obviously don't. At times you'll face tough times. restricted by your circumstances, limited by sickness, injury, or long-lasting conditions that are outside of your control to do anything about. And yet, Joseph found himself in Egypt. We also experience circumstances and events. As Joseph faced prison, we face our trials. They don't have to be empty stages, but rather, maybe we can see them as Joseph did in another element considered preparation for the future. We know that in Romans 8:28, we know that all things work together for the good of those who love God, to those who are called according to his promise and to his purpose. So we know the end of the story, and we see that by the time Joseph stood before Pharaoh, the position may have seemed sudden to many who observed, but the preparation had taken years to be ready to take the role of leadership and control the city. What became visible again to Pharaoh in Egypt, and everyone that noticed, had been forming in Joseph over a long period of time, through multiple trials, things that we would claim to be terrible events that we would not want to suffer, but they made him who he was. And without those trials, without those circumstances, he would not be the Joseph we know today. And that's very close to our life for you and us now. We've been taught, it's been revealed somewhat, we can see a glimpse of the kingdom. But we're still here in training. We know the future God is calling us to, but the work being done now comes in stages. In ordinary days, whether pressure, restraint, whether through patience and learning, we are to continue the process. So as you follow Joseph's life, you see that God was doing more than just helping him through hard times. He was preparing him for something. Joseph kept having things placed in his hand, first in his father's house, then in Potiphar's house, then in the prison, and finally in Egypt. Each stage, he had to decide what kind of man would he be. Can you see how God is working with you? In Matthew 25, we've heard this parable brought out several times, so I won't go through it word for word. But Christ says the kingdom of heaven is like a man who calls his servants and delivers to them his goods. That feels very close to Joseph's life, something placed in the servant's hand, and then time reveals what he does with it. That was Joseph's experience. Potiphar trusted him, left what he had in Joseph's hand. Later in prison, the same thing. And again, over Egypt. Joseph was not yet ruling the nation, but he was already showing what he would do with responsibility. So in the parable, we find that the servants who had received the 5 talents and the 2 talents worked with what they had been given. And there was increase. Then after a long time, when the master returned and settled the accounts, it was very important. A very important part of history and part of the story, because it reminds us, you and I, that time matters. When distance is between us, we have lots of time to do what we want. Do we focus? And that's the question that's coming out in this. The master left for a long period of time. What did the servants do? One who had given 5 increased 5. One given 2 increased 2 more. And the one that was given 1 failed completely. In Joseph's life, he kept serving faithfully at each and every stage that he faced, even though life was difficult. So when you place Luke 19 along Matthew 25, you find that Christ says, because you were faithful in little, in very little actually, have authority over 10 cities. To the second, he said 5 cities. And that brings a little different picture into the equation here, because it extends rulership. Yes, Matthew said become ruler over many things, but in here he calls out cities, which I think is interesting. So this helps us understand where God is taking this process. What is worked on and learned now connects to what we will be entrusted with later. The present is not separate from the future. The way a person handles what is already in his hand says something about what may be entrusted with him in the future. This was true of Joseph. By the time he stood before Pharaoh, the responsibility may have looked large, but the pattern had already been established, and he had already shown the kind of man that he was, one that could be trusted to rule. And we were reminded by Paul in 1 Corinthians 4, verses 1 and 2, similarly. And that is, we are servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. And that is required in stewards that one be found faithful. And that fits Joseph. It fits the parable. It speaks of well of us also. When we think about reward, we should not only think about receiving something, we should think in terms of being found faithful now, because that is exactly what God is measuring. I'd like to dive into an opportunity for you to join in the split sermon today with me in a participatory manner. Let's suppose each one of you is granted by God to create your own city. Not only developing roads and infrastructure, buildings, houses, but the Adam-like create humans, culture, order, reputation, and daily life in your city. Could you imagine a clone of you times 10,000? And now you have rulership. And for the purpose of this exercise, there's only one condition. Attached to every person is your present character. It's easy for us to look at ourselves. It's not as easy to look at 10,000 of us in a single place. Outwardly, they could still have a lot of variety, different faces, backgrounds, different assignments, different kinds of work. But inwardly, the same character would be running through the whole city. They would think the way you think. They would respond the way you respond. They would value what you value. They would excuse what you excuse. They would avoid what you avoid. They would neglect what you neglect. It shows a larger view of yourself, for sure. And sometimes it's hard to see the character clearly in ourselves when it's just us, because we kind of hide from ourselves, really, in a lot of ways. We don't really search as deeply as David did most days. We kind of get used to ourselves. We explain ourselves. We kind of soften our own weaknesses. But when you spread that same character across a whole city, it becomes easier to see what is there. So what would your city be like? What would the people first notice? What would the tone be? Would it be peaceful, honest, orderly? A merciful city, certainly steady. Or would it be tense, slightly delayed, easily offended, undisciplined, spiritually uneven? What would your city be known for? At the simplest level, we're encouraged through Proverbs 20, verse 11, that even a child is known by their deeds, whether he does pure or right. In time, conduct speaks, fruit speaks. A pattern of life tells its story. And as Christ said in Matthew 7:16, he will know us, you could say he will know our cities, by our fruits. That applies to people, and it helps here too. A city is eventually known by what it produces over time. So if your present character became the culture of that city, what fruit would appear everywhere? That is searching, the searching part of this exercise. Is there kindness in you? There will be kindness in the city. If there is patience in you, there will be patience in the city. If there is truth in you, there will be truth in the city. And the other side is true also. Can't ever leave this part out. If there is resentment in you, that will show up in the city. If there is disorder in you, that will spread throughout the city. And if there's excuse making in you, that will become part of the city's atmosphere. This is not really about imagination, brethren, it's about diagnosis. If you're asking, if what is in me now is multiplied, what would become of it at scale? When you let that picture of the city sit in your mind for just a little bit, something starts to become clear. The question is not only what would the city be producing, the question is what kind of ruler would be needed to govern it. That's where the story stops being theological or theoretical. God is showing us the inner man. He's showing us the spirit, the heart, the mind. He reveals us to our habits. He shows us our appetites, our motives, our reactions, the places where our real government is already being revealed inside of us. That's why these days mean so much. We must do the inspection. We must remove the leaven and keep it out. God keeps bringing us back to the same lesson. Before I can govern anything outside of me, I have to learn how to govern myself. That's what Proverbs is getting to when it says, whoever has no rule over his own spirit is like a broken down city, is like a city broken down without walls. Proverbs 25:28. A city without walls is open. It has no protection at its gates. It doesn't stop the wrong things from entering. It does not hold over the way it should. When God uses that image for a man with no rule over his own spirit, he is helping us to see how important the heart is. The intents, the actions are measured and evaluated by God. And if we are honest, we know this is where our real work begins. What's getting into my thinking? What am I allowing to stay there? What do I excuse because it's familiar? What do I keep postponing because I know it would take a lot of effort to deal with it? These are not small questions. These are the substance of yours and my preparation. Because the first city I must learn to govern is the one that's within my heart. In Proverbs 4:23, we're told, keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it spring the issues of life. And that's exactly why Paul, when he speaks about oversight in 1 Timothy 3, verses 4 through 5, he speaks of a man ruling over his own house well, and then says, for if a man does not rule his own house, how will he care for the church of God? It is that plain. It is that direct. And likewise, God does not separate private rule from public responsibility. He connects the two. If a man cannot govern what is nearest to him, he cannot bring order where he has control. Why would greater trust be given to him? It's not harsh, but it shows wisdom by God. Because he cares too much for his people to let someone reign who cannot reign over himself. When we speak about our cities, we're speaking about people. We're speaking about the lives, growth, order, peace, correction, guidance, healing, patience, and absolutely care. It should make sense to us, each one of us, that God would first look at us and ask, what is happening in your heart? Is my way taking hold there? Is there evidence of rule? Is there sincerity? Is there truth? Is there a willingness to be corrected? Is there progress in the spirit increasing? Joseph's example of striving to do right, even when he was treated unfairly over and over again, yet he kept focus on what was given to him. He did the work, and God was with him all the way. And that's what happens to us, brethren. To help others with patience, in order to help others with patience, I need to learn patience. Before I can help others align with God, I must first be aligned with God. If I can learn how not to judge others, I can teach others how not to judge. It seems simple, but Christ was very pointed when he said it this way. In Matthew, the 7th chapter, verses 3 through 5, he said, "Why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye and do not consider the plank in your own? Or how can you say to your brother, 'Let me remove the speck from your eye,' and look, a plank is in your own? Hypocrite," he says, "first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye." He's not saying never to help our brother. He's showing us the order of things. See clearly first. Let correction begin where it should begin. Then let help come from a place of clarity. And that is mercy. So when we come back from the city, coming back to the city image, and we ask ourselves what kind of city our present character would produce, we should not stop there, especially not in discouragement. We should let the question do its work. We should let it show us where God is still teaching us how to rule over ourselves. This is our proving ground. This is where the real work is, where we are tested, and as God walks with us, just as he did with Joseph, we are not alone in the battles that we face. But we must rely on God to make each change or make each challenge we face turn into a good thing. And we begin to see that work in the inner man. You also begin to understand that God is not doing this without a purpose. When Christ returns, the future he brings is real. It's not just a thought that comforts us when life is hard. In the future, under his rule, we will serve with him in his kingdom. In Revelation 20, we know the scripture. It says, "We will live and reign with Christ for 1,000 years. In verse 6, he goes on to say, "And you shall be priests and kings of God and with Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. Brethren, that's a remarkable calling. When we think about it, it helps to slow down and remember what it means. It means service. It means responsibility. It means being with Christ and what he's doing here on earth. It means helping people and helping bring people into the right way of living under God. That's why the prophets speak the way they do in Isaiah 2. When they say, "The nations will say, 'He will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths.'" In Isaiah 30 also it says, "Your ear shall hear the word behind you saying, 'Walk this way. Walk in it. This is the way.'" A beautiful picture of the future. We will be helping people learn God's way, guiding them to the way of peace, truth, and order. People will have come out of this world in the tribulation in a very confused state, and they will need an incredible amount of support. He's teaching us now what we need to know for then, that we can be helpful then. Even if the trials we face on different ways hurt, we consider the words of James, James 1, verses 2 through 4, where James admonishes us through this pattern of life that we face to count it all joy when we fall into the various trials, because the testing of faith produces patience, and patience needs to have its perfect work. In Romans 5, 3, verses 3 through 5, it also states that tribulation produces perseverance, and perseverance character, and character hope. These aren't just words to help us get through a hard week. They help explain what God is forming in us over time. God is building depth, steadiness in each one of us, so we can be a people who can remain under His rule and reflect His mind. That's why it matters now in this present life. What we face now is not disconnected from what God is preparing us for. The lessons and corrections and the growth and the things we learn through pain today, the understanding that comes through experience, these things are not wasted in His hands. When we say and pray, "Your kingdom come, Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven," we're praying toward the future. We're asking for God to order and fill the earth. Under His government. So brethren, it makes sense that He would begin this work in us now. The feast matters because it teaches us to inspect and remove what should not remain. Joseph reflects what shows us what steady growth looks like across multiple stages of life. The parable of the talents helps us understand Christ shows that faithfulness now connects to leadership later, rulership later. The city question matters because it helps us see what our present life is producing, and producing potentially at scale, if you can imagine it. And redirecting the heart, because before anyone lives or our lives are placed in a rulership role, we have to first govern ourselves. There's something encouraging in that. It means that God is working, not working at a random thing. He's leading us somewhere specific. He's patient with us. He's shaping us. And He's doing what the kingdom requires. And when you let all that settle, it begins to come together in a very simple way. This week teaches us to inspect. As we read about Joseph, it shows how God works through stages. And Christ shows us that faithfulness now is connected to what we may be entrusted later. And the inner man keeps coming back into view because that's where the work is. Brethren, the Feast of Unleavened Bread is teaching us something very, very valuable. It's teaching us to look carefully. It's teaching us not to be casual about what remains in our houses. It's teaching us to remove what should not be there, and then to stay with that and work long enough that the lesson begins to shape us. Because the same God who tells us to remove leaven from our quarters is also teaching us to care about what happens in our heart. He's teaching us to search more deeply, to be more honest, and to let His way reach places in us that are easily left alone if we're not paying attention. And when we look at Joseph, we are reminded that this work does not happen all at once. God forms people over time. And He works through stages. And He teaches through responsibility, through pressure, through patience, through setbacks, through correction, and through endurance. I suspect Joseph could not see what was shaping in him as he went through the various trials and the various stages of life. But God was preparing him for something. That should encourage you and I. Because we also are in this process. We are also being taught. We are also being led through things that are shaping us more than we may fully realize now. Then Christ brings us to the parable that reminds us that we are doing now. What we're doing now matters. And what our hand has been given and what we do with that is what God is judging right now. Our faithfulness matters. Our growth matters. How much we are trusted matters. Christ connects faithfulness to rulership. In Luke's account, in Luke 19, it connects us to the cities that we may rule over. If my present character were multiplied, what would it produce? What would it be known for? What would it reflect? Would it reflect order, mercy, truth, patience, faithfulness? Or would it show me plainly the places where I still need to address some pretty specific problems? Don't let this discourage you. It's there to help us. It's there to help us see. And see what's wrong. And being able to see what's wrong is a gift. Because it opens our eyes to what we need to fix. What we need to respond to. Because the first city I must govern is the one within. This is where the work is, where honesty is needed, where growth begins, and where God teaches us to live His way. And the encouraging part is this. God is not showing us these things to push us away. He's showing them because He is preparing us. He is bringing us forward and teaching us what we need to know. So as we continue through these days of unleavened bread, perhaps this question may be in front of us. What is God helping me see in myself? What is God helping me to see in myself that still needs to come fully under His government? And beyond that, if Christ is preparing people for life and service in the kingdom, am I letting Him do that work now? That is the opportunity that is before us. So we must inspect honestly. We must remove what needs removing to keep moving in the right direction and to let God form in us the kind of life that He can trust. Because when Christ speaks of reward, He's speaking about trust. And the cities are entrusted where faithfulness has already been proven. So may we keep the feast with sincerity and truth. And may God continue to shape in each of us the kind of inner life that reflects His way, both now and in the kingdom to come.